The Kids Health Network is brought to you by GP and my daddy, Dr. Andrew Leach. Thanks for tuning in, everybody.
This is the Kids Health Network, the health and psychology podcast for parents and carers of children.
My next guest is Tammy Waite. Tammy has been a go-to person when it comes to understanding the National Disability Insurance Scheme, or the NDIS. She does talks in this area, and that's how I came to know her. She's an experienced disability program coordinator who has worked extensively in the social sector for 16 years. And she also has a personal experience raising two children with autism, both who are on the NDIS. Now, there's around 4.3 million Australians who have a disability. When it is fully rolled out, the NDIS will provide about 460,000 Australians under 65 who have permanent and significant disability with funding for support and services. It is being introduced progressively across all states and territories. But despite all this, I've come to discover the NDIS can be quite confusing. I wanted to demystify some key areas related to the NDIS and make it easier for families. So thanks for joining me, Tammy.
Thank you for having me.
First thing, what is the NDIS?
Okay, so the NDIS, in the past, the way disability services was funded were service organisations would be given government funding, and then the organisations themselves would decide who their client base is going to be and who could access their service. The way the National Disability Insurance Scheme works is that the individual with a disability is allocated funding and then they choose the services that they want to provide. So it gives the person with a disability a lot more choice and control about how they access services to reach their goals.
Okay. So it's an improvement on the current system, I'm guessing?
In theory, it is most definitely an improvement, and the NDIS Act itself is very well written, and it definitely has the purpose of focusing on people with disability being able to live the life that they want to live and to have the same opportunities as everybody else. The problem is that it hasn't been implemented all that well. And as was in the news recently, they have had a massive underspend and this has impacted a lot of people that are accessing the scheme.
Mm. Yeah, so I was also wondering, like, why was it brought out? Were there gaps in the current, you know, in the current system where people missing out on funding? Was the current system not functioning very well? So I guess my question is, why do you think this was brought out? Was it to do with funding that was became available, and or was it to do with a gap in the need?
There certainly were a lot of gaps, and I think the problem was that the services could decide what they want, the services they wanted to provide, and so there was, you know, there sometimes was overlap and then gaps. And the other thing is that there were quite a lot of wait lists, so each service would only have the capacity to take on a certain amount of clients, and then after that you just had to wait until they had, you know, space to take you on. Essentially the other problem was that the clients themselves didn't have a lot of choice about the service provider, and if they weren't happy with the service, often there weren't a lot of other options, so they had to be grateful for what they could get as such.
Okay. And I've come to discover that no service is absolutely perfect. So,
of course,
we're just constantly trying to build them up and make them better, but they all have their difficulties and challenges, which we're going to talk about.
Yes, absolutely. And I think the beauty of the new scheme is that it has created competition, and hopefully it in the long run improves service delivery, because people don't have to put up with insufficient service anymore. They have the option to take their funding elsewhere.
Oh, do they?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that. So it's not automatic that you are required to get NDIS funding. That it's not something that is a requirement. It's an option, and there's other options available. Is that what you mean?
What I'm saying is that the person that has the NDIS package, if they choose an organisation to for community access, for example, and they aren't happy with that organisation, then they can choose a different provider to provide that service.
Ah, I see. Okay. Yeah, and that aspect of it as well, I thought, was automatic too, that the NDIS suggests certain providers. Maybe we'll come back to that when we talk about what is actually included. Who is eligible for the NDIS? Do you know?
So it's people up to the age of 65 that either have a disability, a lifelong disability, or are likely to be permanent disability that affects their function, has a functional impact. So, you know, there are people that have disability that can function in everyday life and have mainstream jobs, and so they wouldn't be eligible. But if it impacts the functional person, the function of the person, then they potentially would be eligible for.
So is there certain criteria then? With when you talk about function, it can be quite vague. Like
it is vague. So when it first started, there were specific diagnoses that would be automatic entry into the NDIS, and now what they've discovered is that within each disability there can be different functioning levels. So now it is all about proving what the functional impact is, so proving that you have functional deficits essentially. So it isn't really about diagnosis, it is the focus is on the functional impact.
So that list of diagnoses is no longer in terms of who automatically gets it? Or does anyone really know?
I think there may still be a list that is automatic eligibility, but the list that is not automatic is a longer list.
Yeah, okay. So just a little bit more about this functional impact. Like, can you give examples of what you mean by functional impact? Like what kind of things would that be?
So things like, does the person need support to bathe themselves or to prepare meals or to access the community? Do they need support to get a job, for example? So can, you know, I guess what it means is, does it impact their independence?
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense. And sort of their ability to look after themselves, their ability to work or function day-to-day life, the ability to go to seek to have education, I guess.
Yeah, and so then the idea is to provide the support so that they have the same opportunities as other people the same age that don't have a disability.
Yeah, it's really important, and it's something I haven't been able to answer when patients ask me, do I need to get this funding? So it's really important to sort of have a clear understanding of who is eligible. That's the first step.
Yes.
And does it have to cross over multiple functional areas, or can they just have, you know, difficulty in one aspect that is able to be applied, you know, go through with this?
That's a good question.
Or you're not sure?
I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, no. That's okay. And we're going to give a whole lot of resources at the end that people can look into this further. Is there an age requirement? So you said under 65. Is there anything within that that changes in terms of the amount or the system, how it works?
So if they enter the scheme before the age of 65, when they turn 65, they actually have the option of either staying in the NDIS or going under aged care services. However, after 65, if they try to enter the scheme, then they won't be eligible.
Okay. And what about children? Is there a cutoff with the lower limits?
Well, yes. So 0 to 7 is early intervention. So with the early intervention pathway, you don't necessarily need a formal diagnosis, but you do need to be able to show that there is developmental delay. So and often the funding for the 0 to 7 is focused on therapy. And then after 7, there's more, they look at perhaps
education support.
They don't actually, this is the one thing that a lot of people get caught on. So they won't fund anything that other areas are responsible for. So they won't fund anything that's to do with education. They won't fund anything that's to do with health or transport. So it gets a bit tricky, but so they wouldn't provide support for the child to access education. However, if the child, for example, needed assistance with personal care during school hours, they may consider supporting, providing funding for that.
Is that for the over seven and over or for all kids? You're talking about all children there?
Seven and over, yes. Yeah.
Can you list what NDIS would fund? That would be good.
Okay. So there's three main budget categories in an NDIS plan that could potentially get funding. So the first budget is called the core supports. So that can include assistance with daily life, which is essentially having supports in the home. So it might be, it might look like a support worker coming in and helping them to get dressed or shower or help them with meal times. And then there's another component called transport. So anyone over the age of 16 is eligible for transport funding if they cannot access public transport independently.
Mm-hmm.
And this also replaces the mobility allowance. So those that are on a disability support pension, and you can be on the pension and access the NDIS at the same time, but the mobility allowance cuts out once you're on an NDIS plan. And then we have another budget called consumables. So predominantly that's for things like incontinence pads, but it can be anything that is related to the disability and is, you know, something that you would use that isn't reusable, I guess.
Mm.
And then the other area of core supports is assistance with social and community participation. So one area talks about support in the home, and then this area is talking about support out in the community. Mm. And then the next budget is called capital, and that's for assistive technology and home modifications.
Mm-hmm.
And then we come to the capacity building budget. So NDIS really like to focus on capacity building. So when you think about the goals that you want in your plan, it's really good to think about how you can word it in a way that's about building capacity. So they really like the words increase and improve in the goals. So the areas within capacity building are support coordination. So not everyone gets funded for a support coordinator, but a support coordinator can help people understand their plan, understand the budgets in the plan, how to implement the plan, how to access services and help them find the appropriate services.
Mm-hmm.
Improved living arrangements. So that's if you're not happy with your current living situation. It might be that you're in a shared home or you're in the family home and you want to live more independently. You can get some funding to help work towards that goal. Increase social and community participation. So that's about increasing your capacity to be able to access the community.
Mm-hmm.
Finding and keeping a job. So that's there's a lot of different options there, but that is around employment. Improve relationships, so that is often around behaviour management and psychology supports. Improved health and well-being, so that can be things like accessing an exercise physiologist or a dietitian. Improved learning, that's around if you need support to education after school. Improved life choices, so this is one that causes a lot of confusion. You can get funding for something called a plan manager, and the plan manager is essentially a bookkeeper. So this is additional funding that you get in your plan, and the plan manager will pay all of your invoices and bills on your behalf. So you don't have to worry about the financial side of things. They will track your budget for you and pay all of your bills. Mm. And it's additional funding that gets added to your plan. So I should talk about the three different ways of managing a plan. I'll just finish off the capacity building because there's one more area. Improved daily living skills. Now, this is often the budget that people get the most funding within capacity building because this is the therapy budget. So this is where you can access allied health that's directly related to your disability. Mm. Mm. So the three plan management styles. So the first one is agency managed, and what that means is that so no one actually physically gets a bucket of money. It kind of sits, I guess, in a portal, electronic portal. And if you're agency managed, that means that you select the service provider, and then the service provider will draw down, well, they will send their invoices to NDIA and then NDIA will pay them directly. So you don't have any...
There's no handover of cash.
No, but the thing is that it gives you the least amount of choice and control, and because you can only use NDIS registered providers if you're agency managed.
Okay.
And it means that you don't really get to see what happens with the funding. The funding just kind of slowly disappears and you don't really have much control over that. Then the other option is self-managed. So that means that you have access to your own portal, you draw down the funds, and then you pay the service providers yourself. Mm-hmm. So in that case, the funds do go into your own bank account, but you have to draw down the money first and you have to keep really accurate records because highly likely that you will get audited if you self-manage.
Mm.
And then there's the option in the middle, which is plan managed. So the benefit of self-managed is that you can use registered providers and you can use non-registered providers, and you're not bound by the price guide, so you can pay whatever you like. Mm.
You just have to be good at keeping your receipts, that's all.
Yes, you have to keep really good records.
Mm.
Whereas the plan managed, I think, is the best of both worlds because it gives you the most flexibility with the least amount of responsibility, because you can still use registered and non-registered providers, but someone else is looking after the financial side of things for you.
Okay. So many questions pop into my head with that. With all those different packages. So,
yes.
So can you access more than one of those groups?
So what happens when you go into your planning meeting, you need to basically tell the planner what supports you feel need to go into the plan. So you need to kind of put your case forward and you need to provide evidence to support the supports that you're asking for. And then the planner builds a plan, and so they will decide whether they think it's reasonable and necessary. That's the criteria that they use to access, to give you court supports in court or supports in capital or supports in capacity building. And then that the plan that they build gets sent to an NDIA delegate who then approves the funding and decides that that is the funding that you're going to receive.
Okay.
And so then you get the plan back, and then by the time the plan comes back to you, it's live, so you don't get any input into whether
you
or
can
not.
Change it. Yeah.
You can appeal,
okay.
But you can't make any changes before that point.
Yeah.
And so I'll just quickly go over the reasonable and necessary criteria because that's often interesting for people to know about. So this is the criteria that they use in the planning meeting when they're deciding what support should go into your plan.
Mm.
So the first is it disability related? Does it meet the goals in the plan? So you need to think really carefully about what your goals are going to be. You can have up to 7 goals, but most plans I've seen have 3 or 4.
Mm.
So the idea is to make them as broad as possible so that it's easy to link your funding to the goal.
I see, yeah. So the goals based on that list that you provided before, or are they separate to that? You talked about different home modification, support with education, social skills.
Are they your
goals?
No, they're not the goals. They are the supports that can go into the plan. So the goals are the things that you want to work towards. So if you're wanting to access fortnightly speech therapy, for example, then you need to have a goal around communication.
Okay.
So that's an example. So you need to really think carefully about what your goals are going to be, because if your goals aren't right and you want to spend funding for a certain thing and it doesn't match your goals, then you can't use the funding for that.
Okay. Yeah. So it gets quite specifically allocated in terms of what you put in.
Yes, which is why you need to keep the goals as broad as possible. I mean, even something as simple as I want to increase my independence, you know, that can be linked to a whole lot of different funding supports. So trying to keep it as broad as possible.
And will the funding come back saying this is the money, this must be allocated to speech therapy for that purpose,
what
or will they say you can now go forward and use it for your goals?
So what happens is they will give you a certain amount of funding in core. If you need assistive technology or home mods, you might get some in capital, and then a certain amount of funding in capacity building. And then unless it's a stated support can only be used for that specific purpose.
Mm.
But otherwise you have the flexibility within that, you have the flexibility in how you use the funding as long as you're working towards the goals.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And sorry I interrupted you there.
That's
you were talking
okay.
about.
Yeah. So reasonable and necessary support. So is it disability related? So, for example, it comes up quite often, like, can I purchase an iPad for my child? And there's no kind of yes or no. It is the purpose that you're wanting to purchase the iPad disability related. So is it so they can have an iPad like every other child, in which case it's probably parental responsibility, or is it because there's some communication apps that you want to put onto the iPad that will help meet one of their goals? So, yeah. So
there's no right or wrong answer there then. So it's a possible thing
yes.
that you could get done.
And
yeah.
and it's particularly if you're self-managing, there's a lot of flexibility. And so there often isn't a right or wrong answer because the whole point of NDIS is to be individualised and it depends what your personal goals are. So, yes, the next one is does it meet the goals in the plan? Does it increase participation in everyday life? Is it value for money? Is it likely to work and does it consider good practice and evidence? Does it take informal supports into consideration? So I often get asked, what does informal supports mean? So if you have a support worker who's in a paid position, that's a formal support, so they're paid support. Informal supports are the family carers that provide the care but don't get paid to do so.
Okay.
So there's a certain expectation that informal supports will provide a certain level of care.
Yeah.
And so the supports that are put into a plan is considered what is above and beyond what would be expected for informal supports.
So you can't start paying yourself because you've got a full-time job looking after your child.
No.
It doesn't work like that.
It doesn't, no. They're very clear about you can't employ family as support workers. And then is NDIS the most appropriate funding body? So, for example, if you said, well, my child wants to go to TAFE and I feel they need a support worker to go with them, then they'll probably say, well, we won't fund that because that is education's responsibility.
Okay. Yep. And is the money always the same for each person, the amount of money that's allocated?
It's never the same.
Oh, okay. Is there a top sort of amount of money that you've seen given out, or is it so unpredictable?
It's all a bit secret screw. Like, I am sure when you go into the planning meeting, they do what's for children, they do what's called a pedicat, and for adults, they do what's called a HUDAS. And I'm sure when they do those,
you need to budget, wouldn't you? Yeah,
you do need to budget,
yeah,
yes.
And they need to budget to work out how much they need to give you.
Well, that isn't how it should work, They should provide what is considered reasonable and necessary to meet your goals.
Okay.
So there shouldn't be limitations as such, but I'm sure that there are bands of funding, and depending on the evidence that you provide and the answers that you give in the assessments that they do, decide what band you fit in. The really difficult part is, though, that you can have all the evidence in the world and still end up with a far less than adequate plan. Or I've seen people who've gone in completely unprepared and ended up with quite reasonable plans. So at the end of the day, it really does depend on the planner that you get on the day, how well they understand your particular disability, what they put into the plan that they build. And then the flip side of that is the delegate that gets the plan to approve, who you never get to meet, and they really don't know anything about you other than what is presented to them. How well do they understand the information, and what do they believe is reasonable and necessary? That's what you're relying on.
Yeah. There are a lot of steps and a lot of people involved in the process.
Yes.
So, you know, getting support is important. I was going to sort of take a step back and walk a family through how to actually get to this stage.
Sure.
So if someone was had a family was diagnosed with a child with developmental delay, you mentioned that before. Should we work out exactly what developmental delay actually means? Is that like a delay of a physical or psychological area of their health in two or more domains?
It's usually two or more domains, correct?
Yeah.
Yes.
So say that became diagnosed, and usually that is diagnosed by a paediatrician, from my experience.
Yes.
So you do need to go through those steps first. After that diagnosis, What is the family meant to do in terms of NDIS?
So for under sevens, Wansley actually have the contract to support those people through the planning process. And so you need to complete what's called an access request form. So they would contact Wansley and ask for an access request form, which they partly fill out themselves, and then the rest needs to be filled out by either a GP or a treating specialist.
Yep.
And what is important for the GP to put in...
Yep,
actually,
I'm listening.
It's probably not that... I mean, I don't know that this actually does apply for the under sevens, because the thing with under sevens is that they want to give them as much therapy as possible in the hope that they may not need that support later. So the criteria isn't quite as strict with the under sevens. But with over seven, if they don't put on the form that they have either that their disability is likely to be permanent or is permanent, they will not get accepted. They'll be automatically rejected. So
okay.
That's the really important thing that the GPs need to be able to say.
Okay, so the under sevens go to Wansley, they complete an access request form, may or may not require any further evidence from the GP because they are pushed through a little bit quicker or a little bit more.
Yeah, I believe that Wansley
lighter.
Do their own kind of assessment as well to to make sure that they...
It's all legitimate.
Yes.
Mm, yeah. And then is it seven and over or over seven? Well, you're not sure. Because I get asked these sort of questions.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm not 100%
That's
sure.
Okay. And this can all be accessed on the NDIS website, which we'll cover. But the seven / over sevens,
yes.
They do the same thing?
So they would, yes. You used to be able to download the access request form off the NDIS website, but for some reason it's not on there now.
No,
you
it's
need
not.
To actually call them and ask them to mail you out a form.
Okay, so who are you calling?
NDIA.
NDIA.
National Disability Insurance Agency.
Yep.
So they're the agency that administer the NDIS.
Their phone number's available online?
Yes.
Yep. So they call the NDIA, they get the form, they fill it in. There's a section or a requirement for a doctor or
Correct.
An allied health or just a doctor?
I think either.
Either
yes.
or. Yeah. So someone involved in the care to
yes.
help you fill that in.
Yes.
And then what do they do?
So then they submit the form along with any evidence that they might have, so any recent what? Assessments or reports or to the NDIA, and then there's a waiting game to find out if they've been accepted into the scheme. If they aren't accepted, they can appeal. If they are accepted, then it's another waiting game to wait for, because it depends what area you're in as well and when that area is rolling out. And so then you have to wait for a planning meeting. So, for example, my boys were both accepted into the scheme in May last year,
mm-hmm.
and we had our planning meetings in March this year.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be quite a significant wait. And then once you get the call to say, this is when we would like to set up the NDIS meeting, then you need to prepare for your meeting, so have your goals ready. Fill in it's called a participant booklet.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's book two on the NDIS website.
Mm-hmm.
And you can take to the meeting either a service provider that's already involved, perhaps your local area coordinator, or someone that you trust and who knows the person with a disability very well and can help support them at the meeting.
Yep. You mentioned the local area coordinator. What do they do?
Mm. So this causes a lot of confusion too. So under the state-funded system, we had local area coordinators that worked for the Department of Communities, and their role was to help you to access services and to access funding. Essentially, their roles have become redundant because now that we're under the NDIS, the federal scheme now have LACs, and their role is to conduct the planning meetings and to put the plans together and then conduct the review meetings at the end of the 12 months. Most plans are 12 months.
Okay, yeah. So they kind of help you through the process, these coordinators.
Well...
Sort of.
They conduct the process.
They conduct the process.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I was looking on the NDIS website for a local area coordinator for our area and I couldn't find that information. So I wasn't sure how you actually figure that out.
Yeah. So this is for NDIS you're talking about. Yeah, the other problem is that there isn't necessarily LACs in all areas yet because not all areas have rolled out.
Oh, that's why.
Yeah.
How much left of Australia is left to go with the rollout? Is it, you know, are we 80% through now or?
I don't know the exact percentage, but we are most of the way through. WA is behind the eight ball because at one stage we were trialling our own version of the NDIS and so that delayed the WA rollout. So we're kind of one of the last to get on board. But by 2020, everybody that is eligible is supposed to be accessing NDIS.
Okay, yeah. And we did talk about there is a delay between that initial application and actually having that meeting to discuss your goals and your plan of, you know, many months for some people. And I should mention from a medical perspective that doesn't mean you have to sit and do nothing in that time. There are other funding models available for allied health, and that's something that we often implement, and that might be a care plan, which, you know, is a team care arrangement is another name for that. And that allows some funding towards, you know, Medicare funding towards allied health needs for children who are eligible. So it is something that you can pick up if you need it. But it's important to look and explore what options you have. There's also public system for allied health, which is also quite slow for some states. But the public system is available as well. So, you know, and getting into the child development service of your local community. So, yeah, don't sort of suffer in silence. Keep pushing for more help if you need it.
Yes. And the other thing is that the state really has a responsibility to keep providing services as well until everybody's on NDIS.
Okay. Yep. There you go. So they've got to that stage where they've had that meeting, set the goals, they've got the funding's been allocated, and then basically they, as we talked about, there's different models of how you can use that, whether you have someone helping you, you do it yourself, or you just get allocated a provider. So do they choose between those options, the parent? Do they have a choice? Or
yes.
That,
yep, okay. Yeah, so at the planning meeting, they hopefully have already made the decision of which way they want to go, and then they will tell the planner or the LAC that's running the meeting how they want the plan to be managed. And it's also important to note that you don't have to manage the whole plan one way either, so you can kind of mix it up. So you might decide that you want to self-manage your core supports, for example, but you want to plan manage your capacity building budget.
Okay.
Or perhaps...
You can mix and match.
You can mix and match, yes.
Yep. So to finish, two questions, like, do you have any tips for people who are getting a bit frustrated or getting a bit lost? Like, what sort of tips would you have, having gone through it yourself as well?
I would say to try and be as prepared as you can before your planning meeting. So learn about the NDIS. You can get support through a disability advocate, or there are organisations such as WA Individualised Services, Carers WA or Calparin who are funded to provide some support during the pre-planning
period. And the equivalents in the other states as well.
Yes.
I'm sure. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, that's right. Every state has their own funded services that can help with the pre-planning. Yeah, I think that you need to have as much evidence as you can to support the supports that you're asking for in the planning meeting. And if you're not happy at any stage, then you can get a disability advocate involved to either appeal the decision if you haven't been accepted into the scheme, or once you get your plan, if you're not happy with the funding in the plan, then you can get a disability advocate involved to help you put in for an internal review.
Okay, yeah. So it's there are opportunities to sort of appeal what's been decided in a way. It's not the be-all and end-all, which is good to know. Yeah.
And in actual fact, you know, the scheme's got a long way to go to get it right, and so it's quite commonplace for people to put in appeals.
Okay. And you've also said here in a blog that I'm reading, talk to others who have navigated the system, which is really important. So don't feel like you're alone. I'm sure others have gone through it. And if you can find a support group that's got that sort of similar goal, that's good as well. And, you know, don't be afraid to use your GP. Whilst we don't have extensive knowledge in this area, we are getting there and we're hearing more and more about it. So we feel that we have got a role in this system and we should be involved in your planning. So for the GPs that are listening, I think, you know, it's good to upskill a little bit in this area because it is going to be with us before very long.
And I think the other message that I would like to put out to GPs is that don't feel that you need that the responsibility is on you to decide if they're eligible for NDIS or not, because that's not what it's about. The NDIS actually, they're the ones that decide, they decide who is going to access the scheme or not. So if someone is wanting to apply, then all you need to do is to assist them to fill in the form to access.
Yeah, it doesn't fall to you. Exactly. Yeah. It involves a lot of people, this whole thing.
Yes.
So are there any good books parents can look at or websites? I will put the NDIS website in and phone numbers. Before the podcast, we said there are heaps of resources. Is there any one really good book that the parents could consider looking at or not?
There's a lot of websites, and definitely I would encourage people to have a look for groups on Facebook that are associated to their particular area, because then they can find out what services are out there and access local information. But one website that I would encourage people to access is called The Growing Space. They have on their website a library of resources. Some of them are free and some of them you can pay a membership that you can claim from your NDIS funding to access those resources.
Okay. I know a couple as well that I'll put up that I've heard from patients, and I'll put them up, a book and website. But that's it today. I wanted to thank you so much for coming, Tammy. You've demystified a lot of things that I thought were too hard to tackle. So I think I had to have this discussion with you. And 2020 is when it's expected to hit us, you know, in terms of all of Australia, we're going to be hearing more about the NDIS. So it's a really good start, and we'll keep working through those questions over time. Hopefully I get to chat to you again sometime.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to the Kids Health Network. Be sure to keep an eye on our Facebook page for updates.